Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I am Lori Walsh. South Dakota is a state with a strong tradition of distinguished military service. George A. Larson is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel. He's also the author of the new book, South Dakota War Stories. He joins us today from our studios in Rapid City to talk about the project and the book. Welcome to Dakota Midday, sir.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Let's start with the book itself. It's more than 600 pages. It spans the 1800s to the 21st century. How did you sort of plan the comprehensive scope of this work?
Very interesting. People in South Dakota are so, it's such a historical work. I wanted to have a starting point. You always, in a book, you have to have a starting point. And I thought, what more important than the Lewis and Clark Corps of Discovery when it went through South Dakota? That's kind of the story of when we actually started with people's stories in the military, and I thought that was a really, really good place to start.
And then you just kept going.
Just kept going and said, where are you going to stop? Because you have the planes, you have World War One, you have World War Two, you have Korea, Vietnam, you have Afghanistan, and then you have the Cold War. You have all these intertwined stories. And I've always wanted to do a storybook because my other books are basically stories with a lot of pictures in it. But I've always wanted to do a story of telling veteran stories, of telling people's life stories, so their families would have that information.
So tell me a little bit about your own military career in the Air Force.
Yes, I would. I graduated from Iowa State University in 69. I went to intelligence school at Lowry Air Force Base. I was assigned to SAC headquarters, a strategic intelligence officer, basically on the Soviet Union and China. And then I was assigned to bomb wings, like at Anderson Air Force Base, where I was a nuclear weapons officer as well as their intelligence officer. I taught at Castle Air Force Base as an instructor, and then back overseas to Anderson Air Force Base. And then my dad was a CB during World War II. And he actually was on Tinian Island, and after an ORI, the SAC Inspector General said, what would you like to do? Would you like to have your parents come over? And they flew my parents over to Guam, and I had a chance to take my father to Tinian Island, where he served during World War II. And it's a story of a lifetime where a son got to walk in his father's footsteps during World War II. Because he helped build the runways that launched the Enola Gay that ended World War II.
What did you talk about during that trip with your dad?
He never talked about it before. And I said, what was it like being away from mom? What was it like being in a wartime zone? Then he told me he was chased off of a grader by a Japanese Betty bomber from, was stationed out of Iwo Jima. He got knocked off the grader and bullets were flying. He never talked about anything he did. And then he said, well, this is where my Quonset hut was. This is where I worked in the gravel pit. This is where I worked on building the runway. This is where I met Colonel Paul Tibbetts, who was commander of the 509th Composite Group. And I had a chance to talk about what he did versus what I did. And it was one of those things where I never knew what he did, and this is what kind of got me started. There's a lot of stories out there for people who did these things and they never told anybody. And the more I started doing the research, I was just fascinated by the stories I was finding.
Did you just go back and write everything that he said down? Did you record it? Did you?
Well,
did you
I recorded it? A lot of it. The reason I was in an intelligence service, I have a photographic memory. And so I would basically sit down and then write it down. I had pages and pages and pages. Good thing I did, because later on in his life, because when he was blown off a grader because of a construction accident, too much dynamite next to the runway, he developed Alzheimer, and he died. And unfortunately, the last year of his life, I had him here in Rapid City, and I could actually take care of him. But I had his stories, and that started me thinking about, what else can I do? And that's kind of where I went into this book on.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm sorry about the loss of your dad. Glad you had that time together. Tell me a little bit about this Black Hills Veterans Writing Group and how that ties into this book.
Great. We have a lot. It started about 10 years ago. And I didn't start it, but I've been a member ever since. The idea was to try to get veterans to write their stories. And we have a monthly meeting that we go to. In fact, what I started doing is I tracked a lot of the people down there, and they started giving me their stories. A lot of them still won't talk about it. But these are people who are the full gamut of military history in South Dakota. And telling their life experiences is a way to open up and way to pass on their stories. And I like doing this because it tells a history. And I like the printed format to put it down so we have it for a permanent record.
What makes, in your experience, someone not want to tell the story of their military service?
A lot of times there's trauma. There's a lot of times there are things they're trying to forget. Or they just say, well, I was there and I really didn't do anything important. My dad was a good example of that. He said, well, I really didn't do anything important. Hmm. Well, because of him, I have another book that's on Whiteman Air Force Base, because now the commander of Whiteman Air Force Base is Colonel Paul Tibbetts IV, who's the grandson of Paul Tibbetts, who my dad met. Hmm.
Would you say it's a humility, or would you say it's, are these just generally humble people who don't want to talk about it and think they
haven't
done anything?
I think it's both. I think a lot of people think, well, you know, that was just something they had to do.
Mm. And what makes someone get past that hesitation and see the value in telling a story or writing it down?
I think it's a lot of now that they are looking upon other stories that people are finding out. Like one gentleman, his name is Paul Priest. He's the only surviving member now of his unit that was with the 9th Armored Division. They captured and crossed the bridge at Remagen. And I did a story on him. I did a book on him. Eventually, if all goes well, I'm working right now on the initial deals of hopefully doing a movie on him. Hmm. But they see other people who have told stories. I'm going to use myself as an example, of course. So they start telling me stories, and they said, why don't you do me? I get phone calls about one or two a week from people in South Dakota who want me to tell their life stories. Hmm. And I do it. I print it out. I don't charge them anything for it. The reason I do it is because I want this history to survive. A lot of people now who are on fixed incomes or people who don't know how to get the research, I like to do it for them so then they'll have something to give their family, their grandson, their great-grandsons of this is what our family did.
So if you served as an officer and then you've also spent a lot of time with individuals, enlisted and other, what have you learned about military history from a big picture from talking to individual people who had experienced a small portion of that history?
People like myself who are now professional writers, we've just barely even scratched the surface. There is so much in my particular case. I cannot write about what I did because it was all classified, because when I retired, I had a 70-year non-disclosure, so I can't write about what I did. So I write about other people. I tell them, let's do it. I've got sources where I can go to get primary sources, so I can get documents about the military history, fill in the gaps, and it's fascinating. It's like you just had the individual on talking about the Mandan Indians. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in South Dakota, they have no idea about this. It's one of these things that's just opened your eyes.
70-year non-disclosure. Are you going to live long enough to tell some of those stories?
I would love to. I don't know if I'm going to make it or not, but I'd love to. But so I've taken to the point now where I've got some of my stories in the book that I was able to tell about Operation New Life, the Vietnamese coming to Guam, and other things that were not classified. But
tell me one of those stories. Tell me. Bring
yeah,
me,
yeah,
bring
I
me
was
into
on
the
Guam.
Book.
I was in charge of intelligence. Mm-hmm. And the fall of Saigon, I was sitting at my desk, and I got a phone call from my other boss, who was the Navy admiral down at Big Navy, which ComNav Mariani said, oh, yeah, your dad was a CB. He said, I want you to be my liaison officer because we've got 100. We're expecting 130,000 Vietnamese in about 3 days. Hmm. So we had to set up camps. I had to organize my people to do the debriefs. And since I had the intelligence vault, we had to store all the valuables. I had one lady. This is a great story. She's probably 85 years old, maybe weighed 95 pounds. She couldn't get up off the floor of the C-130. She was wrapped in gold bot chains. And luckily I had some of my people who could speak Vietnamese who convinced her to unwrap it, and we weighed it, gave her a receipt so that she could then get her money back when she left. It was, you know, that's how they did their deal. My wife was a Red Cross volunteer who helped clothe a lot of these people. It was a big event. We eventually processed over 133,000 Vietnamese through Guam.
Through Guam, which is the size of what?
It's about
I've been to Guam.
It's about 7.5 miles wide, about 12.5 miles long, and we were just basically, the Air Force went into a war mode to feed all these people.
Right. So these are refugees, and
refugees from the fall of Saigon.
And they're going where?
They went to some of the United States. They went to Canada. They went to some went to Europe. Some went to into the Scandinavian countries. Canada, the United States. We took the bulk.
How many translators did you have to speak to those people?
On my group, to start with, I only had four, but then the Air Force brought in a lot more people. And so we were running 12-hour shifts. And on a normal translation basis, once we got it set up, we had people who were in the camps who actually worked for us, who could speak English and then could speak Vietnamese. Hmm. So once we got it started, we had a pretty good system going.
And how long was the average refugee there on Guam?
The ones that had money, they left pretty early for the States. The other ones, it took a while. We were actually up and functioning for about 90 days, for about 6 months, and we were then kind of winding down.
That's fast, though.
It was pretty good because we were trying to take care of them the best way we can. So, yeah.
And what kind of relationship did they have with you after what they had been through in their country and the trauma that they were going through? How did they respond?
Unfortunately, I have never really got back into those.
Yeah,
that's just one of those things. There were so many people. It's something I didn't really keep track of. I do know that the Chaplain's Corps on Guam, they kept some of them stayed on Guam, and we got them what they call initial Zodiacs. They became fishermen, and they're still there, but I haven't been back there since I left Guam.
That meant at the time, did you notice the?
I knew quite a few of the people who were translators. But there were so many faces coming in. It's like if you're taking movie tickets, you kind of remember the first one, but then after it got to the middle of it, you don't remember the faces.
Tell me another story. Bring me to another chapter in that book. And
you bet. I certainly will. Another chapter I want to bring into is have a gentleman who was in World War II, and his name was Tom McDill. He lived at Custer, and one day I got this phone call. It was from his wife, and he said, "We've heard you from the South Dakota Veterans Writing Group. Would you like to come down and talk to my husband?" I said, "Sure." Instructions to his house. He went past Crazy Horse to the RV center, made a right turn, and then after that, you kept turning left till you couldn't make any more left turns. After about 10.5 miles, I hit his house. He was on General MacArthur's staff in the Philippines at the start of World War II. Survived Bataan laying communications cable. Survived the Philippine POW camps. Survived the hell ships going to Japan. Survived working in the copper mines. On August the 5th, he was told, his whole POW camp, that they're going to start executing people in groups of 10 on August the 6th. Well, on August the 6th, we dropped the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. His wife had never heard this story. I hear this sobbing behind me, and she's crying profusely because her husband never told that. It's the first time he ever told a story, and it's in the book. And I have another gentleman that I'm writing his story on, who was on Corregidor and kind of went through the same thing.
Now, how do you sit down with somebody and get that story out of them? Are they just ready to tell it?
No, what I do, I introduce myself. I tell them about my military history. I tell them about my father. I tell them about other things and say, you know, what have you done? And they start, you know, I try to get them to open up. Mm-hmm. And I was trained as an interrogator also in the Air Force, and that really helped.
And you've used your powers for good now.
So yes.
continue to.
Yes.
And how old was that gentleman when he finally told that story in his
94
wife?
94 years old.
And they had been married how long, do you think?
He had been married about 53 years.
And she had no idea?
No.
What's the value in that to him to tell that story at the near the end of his life?
What it is now, his family, like the other families I've done, they've got a record of his World War II service. And you want to, I have used the phrase, and it's been overdone, the greatest America's greatest generation. Mm-hmm. People who sacrificed all in all to not just save our country, but to save the world, which my dad was of. If it hadn't been for my dad, I don't think I would have joined the service.
Hmm. Where do we begin collecting or writing down our own stories? Where's a good place to start?
You start a tape recorder. You sit around a cup of coffee at a table, and just start. Don't try to put anything in organization. Just talk. And eventually, that gives you what you call a foundation. Say, for example, if you were a person was a member of the 9th Armored Division. Well, we've got sources where I can go. Since I was a member of the Army War College, I can get that information, or the Navy War College, or the Air Force War College. I've got sources in the Pentagon. I've got sources through all the different military channels where I can go to that basically I'm a free access person. In other words, if someone asks me for information, I give it to them. So my reputation is around now that I can just get all these stories, information, and people just give it to me. And that's where you have to start.
So what are the obstacles that you have to overcome? I'm sure some people are intimidated about the idea of writing it down. They can't spell right.
They are. And I said, it's very easy, especially now with the current word processors we have. I said, don't worry about it. Just write it down. Just give it, just make your rough notes. Give me, a lot of these people have photographs that they have in their house that they haven't looked in years. Mm-hmm. Talk about a gold mine. Then I put it together, what they call a storyboard, notes, give them an outline, and then basically what I try to do is I give them a word processor disk. And then whatever they want to do with that, it's up to them.
Where can we get copies of the book?
They can get them from me, Lieutenant Colonel George Larson. I live here in Rapid City. Saturday, I'm going to be at the Black Hills Veterans Writing Group from 9 to 11 at South Dakota Air and Space Museum. I'm going to be telling my story on this book. Plus, I'm going to be doing a seminar for about an hour on how to do what you and I just talked about.
We will put a link up to the Black Hills Veterans Writing Group on our website, sdpb.org/Dakota Midday, so folks can find that even more easily. Lieutenant Colonel Larson, thank you so much for joining us today, sir.
Have a great day, and thank you for having me on in charge of all the veterans.
We are going to take a break. When we come back, Jim Spears and Brian Bondi on connecting people to the arts and inspiring artists to connect and grow South Dakota's cultural landscape. You're listening to Dakota Midday on SDPB Radio.